Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, a building in Shanghai has been pointed the finger at by a U.S. computer security firm, saying that its hacking to Western interests takes place there. China is set to take over a port in Pakistan, and nearly 2 years on after the meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, it seems that some people are being asked to give back compensation. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. A new report from a U.S. computer security firm, Endian, says it has traced a string of high-level international cyber attacks to a specific area of Shanghai, run by the Chinese military unit 61398. A white 12-story building owned by the army is a dominant feature of the hacking-prone area. And while the report cannot prove that the hackers were operating from inside the building, it says that it's the only plausible explanation. But the Chinese Foreign Ministry has strongly denied the accusations, saying it has also been a victim of cyber espionage. Next, Liam Cochran speaks to Professor Matthew Warren from the School of Information at Deakin University.
Well, it's actually very interesting because the report itself is quite fascinating. It really is a forensic investigation of cyber attacks spanning a period of time since 2006. And it's quite fascinating because the report details the attack strategies, the infrastructures that they have in place. And again, what it highlights is the source of the attacks that they're, you know, from this particular area in China. What we don't know is whether Unit 61398 actually is a physical unit, whether it's a shadow unit, what's their role, whether they're, you know, government-sponsored or support, whether they're more a sort of a more shadowy organization. But one thing is very clear is the role that China as a country, maybe not China as a government, is involved in cyber espionage. And I think really what this report highlights is the cyber activities that are being undertaken against Western corporations and the sheer quantity and type of information that's been stolen, many of which is related to business operations, business plans, research, etc. Very key information that would give, you know, a rival organization a lot of competitive information, if not a real competitive advantage.
We're always very careful when discussing this to make the distinction between hacking that comes from China and hacking that is done by the Chinese government. This report seems to narrow the difference between those two things. Do you think it is that we are getting closer to the point where the US or another group could definitively say the Chinese government is operating a large-scale hacking operation around the world?
In terms of cybersecurity, this is always the grey area. Just because attacks can originate to a particular country, particular group, you know, whether the responsibility lies with a particular government department is hard to define. I suppose what it does highlight in it, is the extent of which information has been stolen. Very recently, we've had the Australian government, you know, in the national security strategy actually say that, you know, the Australian government and citizens are at risk of cyber espionage and foreign interference. So again, it's something that we're seeing happening around the world. But the problem with cyber crime and the activities, the way in which it operates, you can link it back to organizations, entities, which this report does. The issue is whether that entity and group is actually part of a government or a shadowy organization of a government. You know, we've seen the concepts of cyber militias, of third parties acting on behalf of other organizations. I think that, certainly with the information that's put forward, is hard to define. But I think what will happen is there will come a time when Western governments around the world will make a statement and they say these practices will have to stop, and they will blame particular governments and say, you will have to be responsible for these activities, because the sheer number of the attacks, the sheer amount of data that's been stolen literally globally around the world, you know, has to be coordinated, it has to be planned, it has to be resourced.
Well, let's talk about the nature of the data that's being stolen. What did the report say about the organisations that are being targeted and the kind of information that's being stolen?
Well, again, it certainly ties in. There's a lot of terminology. It certainly ties in with the terminology and concept of cyber espionage rather than cyber warfare or cyber attacks. So in terms of the outcome of these attacks, the sorts of information that's been stolen, you know, it's very much to do with organizational plans, research and developments, information. What's also interested is related to this, we're now seeing other sorts of spin-offs of attacks, you know, on social media that's also collecting maybe additional background information. So I think what you begin to see is a very focused attack. What we haven't seen is how that information is then being used. You know, in terms of the Soviet era, you know, when cyber espionage occurred, military secrets were stolen, and you saw Soviet aircraft appear that looked very similar to Western aircraft. We're not. This is a very different situation. What you're seeing is information being stolen and used for very much more of a competitive advantage, understanding economic competitors, what they're doing, how markets are reacting. And also, in many cases, with China now part of the global economy, the competitors to large Chinese organizations in terms of the strategies that they have in place, the activities, research and development that's been undertaken.
China is set to take control of Pakistan's Gwadar Deep Seaport, a major link to the Straits of Hamad's oil shipping lanes. Beijing funded 80% of the port development as part of a plan to create a trade corridor from the Gulf states to China. But Pakistan's decision to relinquish control entirely to China has raised concern about China's influence in the region that holds more than half of the world's oil reserves. Katie Hammond has the story.
The Gwadar Port project began in March 2002, touted by Pakistan as a future business hub to rival Dubai. China funded 80% of the $248 million development, but the Port of Singapore Authority, or PSA, was initially assigned control of the port when it opened in 2007. Since then, it has been a commercial failure, in part because Pakistan has yet to complete a road linking Gwadar with the rest of the country. Last year, PSA decided to abandon its 40-year development contract amid ongoing disagreements with the Pakistani government over the allocation of land, paving the way for a Chinese state-owned company to step in this week. Islamabad has given its blessing to the new arrangement, with President Asif Ali Zardari describing it as an auspicious moment. China is the world's second largest importer of oil, but 80% of it must travel through the unsafe Strait of Malacca and South China Sea. Gwadar Port is an essential plank in their plan to develop a more secure energy route. A railroad and oil pipeline linking Gwadar with Kashi in western China would significantly shorten the distance between Beijing and the oil-rich Middle East. But the plan to develop overland transport channels will likely be many years, if not decades, in the making. Rory Medcalf is the director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute.
To use an unfortunate pun, it's a pipe dream at this stage, because China would be essentially building an overland oil pipeline through some of the most politically volatile terrain in the world and over some of the most inhospitable geography in the world. So I think this is a very long way from fruition, but it is part of a dream, I guess, in China to reduce dependence on seaborne imports of oil, which are, of course, vulnerable to attack or blockade by foreign shipping or by foreign navies during a crisis.
Which raises the question of whether China intends to use Gwadar Port as its own naval outpost. Beijing has so far refused to rule out this possibility, which has set off alarm bells across the border in India. India's Defence Minister A.K. Antony has described China's control of the port as a matter of concern. What New Delhi and Washington fear is that Guada will become part of China's so-called String of Pearls strategy, a plan to develop a series of Chinese-controlled ports spanning the Indian Ocean. Rory Medcalf believes this could ultimately be China's intention, but the question of international naval bases is still a matter of debate in Beijing.
We shouldn't exaggerate the issue, however. There's no evidence at this stage that China is planning a military use for this facility. And moreover, the topography of Guada is such that it would not be easily defended in a conflict. It's essentially an isolated port in a fairly desolate open area, which would be very difficult to defend if China came to blows with the United States or India in that part of the world.
Nearly 2 years from the meltdown at Japan's nuclear Fukushima power plant, there are accusations that the nuclear industry is evading its responsibilities and forcing the public to pay compensation to victims of the fallout. A report from the environmental activist group Greenpeace that was released this week points out that firms that help design and build the Fukushima reactors are not required to pay a cent in compensation and are profiting from the disaster. Meanwhile, the ABC, that's the Australian Broadcasting Program, AM, has learned that the operator TEPCO is handing out what it called temporary compensation to victims of the meltdown, now have to repay that money. We have this story from Mark Willisey.
Yukiko Kameya was born and raised in Fukushima, but the 68-year-old knows she'll probably live out her days in a tiny public housing apartment in Tokyo's colourless urban sprawl. Mrs. Kameya used to live in Futaba Town next to the Fukushima nuclear plant, but then came the tsunami of the 11th of March, 2011.
We were living just 1.2 kilometres from the plant, and we escaped with nothing but the clothes on our back.
Mrs. Kameya was initially given $18,000 in compensation from TEPCO, but of that, $11,000 was so-called temporary compensation, meaning once a final settlement was reached, that money would have to be paid back.
We had that money deducted from our compensation. I was surprised, so I called TEPCO and said that they were using dirty tricks, that they were using fraud. Why did they give it to us if we had to pay it back?
TEPCO has told AM that because it takes time to calculate the exact compensation each evacuee is entitled to, the company decided to advance them some money to tide them over, and that money would be deducted from the final compensation. Mrs. Kameya's testimony is one of several evacuee stories contained in a Greenpeace report to be released later today, which claims that the tens of thousands of victims of the meltdowns are still denied fair compensation 2 years on from the disaster. But not only that, the report details how companies that helped design and build the Fukushima nuclear plant, such as General Electric, Toshiba and Hitachi, have been shielded from having to pay any compensation. Aslahan Tuma is Greenpeace's international nuclear project leader.
Now, nuclear suppliers are completely protected from accepting any liability or being held accountable in case of an accident. GE designed Fukushima React Mark I reactor, and both GE, Hitachi and Toshiba built and continued servicing the reactor. And they are also still making, in some cases, money out of the cleaning efforts as well as the contamination.
With the operator TEPCO effectively nationalised, the Japanese taxpayer is now picking up most of the compensation bill for the disaster. For victims like Fukushima resident Yukiko Kameya, no compensation will ever be able to return her to her home.
We've been back to our home four times for a quick visit. The roof has leaked and no one can repair it because the radiation is too strong. So everything inside has become rotten. So that, plus the radiation, means we can never go home again.
Nearly 2 years on, this disaster has mostly fallen out of the news and its victims remain largely hidden. Hidden in tiny, so-called temporary apartments in villages, towns and cities across Japan.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Vietnam's prime minister has set out a range of ambitious targets for the economy. He aims to achieve an investment grading rated by 2020. But he faces an uphill task to achieve what some analysts seem like an impossible task. Most believe Vietnam faces a bleak future without radical change. Karen Snowden has more.
Not so long ago, Vietnam was the economic darling of Asia. But in the last few years, the shine has gone off. Corruption, a lack of reform, banking sector weakness, property prices falling, 50,000 small businesses shut down last year alone, and now anecdotal evidence of rising depression and suicide rates. Vietnam's bright future has been replaced with a dark cloud of gloom.
Definitely. Vietnam's still struggling.
Katrina L., an associate economist with Moody's Analytics. She says while Vietnam is affected like everyone by the global slowdown, it's really its own worst enemy.
The politicians there haven't been able to get their act together and really improve transparency and fight corruption. So it's just lagging behind and it's not able to live up to its potential. We're not confident that they're going to get their act together anytime soon to restart that strong growth that they had in the past 10, 20 years.
The country is struggling with a rate of growth that's the lowest in more than a decade and nervous foreign investors. The Prime Minister, facing political pressure due to the level of cronyism and corruption, says he can boost growth and exports and achieve the much sought-after investment grade rating within a decade. Already, increases for healthcare and education spending have been delayed to help the government's financial position. Daniel Martin, Asia economist with Capital Economics in Singapore, says Vietnam is likely to just muddle through below its potential.
I think it's probably a bad time to really be talking about Vietnam reaching investment grade. I mean, it's probably at its lowest point for quite some time. Now, that's not to say that Vietnam can't reach investment grade. Indonesia just reached it last year, and if we look back a decade ago, there's no way we'd have predicted it would have done the same.
And so there have been tiny moves towards banking reform, perhaps looking at the loss-making and corruption-prone state-owned enterprises, but it sounds like the pace really needs to pick up in those areas.
That's right. They've arrested some bank officials who look like they were engaged in corruption. It looks like they're trying to consolidate the sector, reduce the number of banks and try and get some bigger, stronger banks rather than many smaller ones. But yeah, you're right, a lot more needs to be done. We think that probably the Vietnam government will go about halfway with this, a kind of muddle through, and that won't be enough to get Vietnam back to the rates of growth we have been seeing before the financial crisis.
Slower growth is harming the real economy, unemployment is rising, and people are suffering hardship. Katrina L.
Why wouldn't they feel pain when the government can't get its act together? And inequality is also rising too, because you've got the problems on the ground and, you know, people aren't able to find jobs, and that then affects their families. Whereas you've still got those high income earners being able to maintain that level because of corruption and that sort of thing, which is a real shame in the economy because it does have so much potential with its young, dynamic workforce. It can offer a lot to the global economy and benefit from that, but it's just not able to.
Vietnam needs lots of new roads and other infrastructure, but doesn't have the money to build them. Daniel Martin.
Its debt, around 40% of GDP officially, maybe a little bit higher than that unofficially. And its fiscal deficit is wider than it should be comfortable with. So the government doesn't really have the money to put into these things. And Vietnam has some of the worst roads, the worst port infrastructure in Asia. So even though it was really the darling of Asia 5 years ago, there were still a lot of problems with getting your goods around Vietnam. And that's something that is going to need to be addressed. And it's going to involve attracting foreign money. And the way the country's looking at the moment, with investors really nervous about the banking sector and transparency and corruption, it's going to be difficult to get the foreigners to come in and put the money into those things that need to be done.
Katrina L. says using the Philippines as a role model, Vietnam could in future return to higher growth and attract investors.
It just maybe needs to make reform a bigger priority than what it has been.
In many parts of Asia, mental health is something that still has a stigma attached to it. One of those countries where it is very well attached is, of course, is Indonesia, where mentally handicapped patients are quite often shackled. The practice known locally as pusung was banned in 1977, but continued to thrive because of inadequate mental health services, especially in rural areas. Now, the government has made it a priority to train more mental health professionals and make their services more accessible to those who need it the most. We have this story from Kandahar Sapati.
The World Health Organization estimates that up to 85% of mental health disorders are not being treated in low- and middle-income countries. In Indonesia, there are only 33 specialized mental health hospitals and 600 psychiatrists to deal with some 19 million people suffering from various mental health disorders, including anxiety and depression, and another million from severe psychosis. Under its Global Mental Health Action Plan, the WHO is recommending all countries allocate at least 5% of its public health expenses to mental health care by 2020. Dr. Pandu Setiawan, a consultant psychiatrist and a former mental health director at Indonesia's Health Ministry, says lack of funding and accessibility to mental health professionals and drugs are the biggest obstacles in the efforts to end pusung, or the shackling of mental patients.
We only have around 1% of budget from mental health, but now we have found in the last 3 years that we want to train more and more medical doctors, GPs, nurses in the primary health care, and also in the general hospital at the district level. And we hope in the next year, we may be more than 30 or 40% of GP and the nurse has been trained for this. And also, on the other hand, we try to provide enough funding to buy for the medication.
With the cost of psychiatric consultation and drugs way beyond the reach of many poor Indonesians, the tendency has often been for people to turn to spiritual leaders or dukuns to find recourse for the illness. Anthony Stratford is with Mind Australia, a community mental health organisation which is working alongside Indonesian counterparts to deal with the issue of pusung. He says when people turn to dukuns, mental illness takes a different form, that of magic.
There is still this undercurrent of magic that runs through much of the society, and this is where the pusung is involved. That they believe that it's possession by evil spirits. And so there needs to be a lot of education around this, a lot of support to families especially, and to villages.
Dr. Setiawan agrees. He says until recently, as many as 50% of mental health patients go first to the dukuns before seeking the assistance of the mental health professionals. He says families cannot be blamed for shackling their mentally ill. Instead, he says the government needs to take part of the blame.
We cannot blame all to the family. We blame also for our not enough funding for the primary health care and not enough training for our health provider. For not enough funding to have some medication. We have to admit this before we make this program happen.
Mental illness not only carries with it a social stigma, but often families are ostracized by the local community and forced to shackle their sick, says Mr. Stratford.
The family is the core of society in Indonesia. Now, often it's the family who's isolated when their child becomes unwell, but the thing is that if we can get education around this and support around this, I believe that it will make a big change in Indonesian society.
Dr. Setiawan says changing people's attitude towards mental illness is essential. And to this end, some steps are being taken.
We do a lot of advocacy and lobby program for this at every level of government to make a stigmatization for this mental illness. And they can be more aware about mental health issues, not only for psychotic, but also for the prevention. And the most important is about the rehabilitation issue.
Dr. Setiawan says there is also a need for people to understand that there are other types of mental health disorders apart from psychosis.
Formerly, we only focus on the psychotic schizophrenic people. On 2007, we have more and more non-psychotic people that should be treated well also. Not within the mental hospital, but in the community or in the primary health care.
An Indonesian court has heard a convicted people smuggler involved in a deadly boat voyage had links to four men in Australia. Dawood Amir, or Ifan, has been jailed for 6 years for organizing four asylum seeker boats, including one which sank last June, killing 90 people. The kingpin of the smuggling syndicate hasn't been found. Outlining how Ifan organized the boat trips, the judges named his contacts in Australia. Indonesian police also accused an Afghan-born Australian as being part of the operation. We have this story from George Roberts in Jakarta.
Holding back the media scrum, security guards at the East Jakarta court ushered Dawood Amiri from the prison van to the courtroom. The 19-year-old Afghan man, known as Irfan, sat facing the judges. At the back of the court, his 31-year-old wife, Sri Hatati, bit her thumb as the judges summarised the case. Here's Chief Judge Mariana.
Terdakwa Dawood Amiri alias Irfan telah terbukti secara sah dan meyakinkan bersalah melakukan tindak pidana orang asing yang berada di wilayah Indonesia tanpa memiliki dokumen perjalanan dan visa yang sah.
One of the four boats Irfan admitted to organising sank north of Christmas Island last June. Of the 204 asylum seekers on board, 90 died. Prosecutors asked for a 7-year jail term and a fine of 750 million rupiah, or about $75,000. Justice Muriana again.
Menjatuhkan pidana kepada ia terdakwa. Oleh karena itu, dengan pidana penjara selama 6 tahun, serta pidana denda sebesar 750 juta, dengan ketentuan apabila denda tersebut dibayar harus diganti dengan pidana kurungan selama 6 bulan. Menetapkan masa penahanan yang telah dijalani oleh terdakwa.
And so, Irfan was led away to the holding cell. What the case uncovered is more about the people smuggling network Irfan worked for. The judges described how Irfan was recruited as a UN-recognised refugee while himself attempting to get to Australia. An alleged Afghan-born but Indonesia-based syndicate boss called Jared Mahmood was identified but hasn't been caught. The judges found the network had connections stretching from the Middle East to Australia. One judge mentioned four men living in Australia that Irfan was in contact with. He named the men, but for legal reasons the ABC can't. Meanwhile, an Afghan-born Australian man called Ali Qasim was also arrested in Indonesia and is awaiting trial, accused of being part of the same syndicate. After his verdict, Irfan sat in a holding cell.
I don't want to talk about anything.
In the busy public area, his wife Sri Hatati said the verdict was unfair.
Dari cerita dia sih, dia kan kerjanya cuma gitu doang kan, ngumpulin orang gitu. Kalau menurut saya sih, kalau cuma begitu kerjanya ya terlalu berat juga ya. Ya nggak tahu ya, mungkin ya kurang dari itu lah.
She says she's also sad about the 90 people who died en route to Christmas Island.
Ya sebagai manusia ya kita gimana sih, ya ikut sedih juga ya Pak ya, prihatin gitu kan. Ya gimana ya? Ya kasihan juga sama orang-orang yang itu, yang dapat musibah itu kan.
Irfan has a week to consider filing an appeal.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone, and have a good weekend.